Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, text number 42, lucky last text for this chapter. The next chapter, just give you a preview, coming events. We have the manifestation of Brahma from Gavadaksha Vishnu.
Shri-sukkuru-vacca
Saritham apriṣṭhā puraṁ halkalpaha
Kuru-pradhinnā-muni-pradhannaha
Prabhriddhā-harṣo-bhagavat-kattayam Tastham prahasan nivaha Shri Sukadeva Vacha
Shri
Sukadeva Goswami said
Saha
He Itam Thus Aprishta In question Uranakalpaha One who knows how to explain the supplements of the Vedas, the Puranas. Kuru Pradenha. By the chief of the Kurus. Muni Pradenha. The chief amongst the sages. Prabhridha. Sufficiently enriched. Harsha, satisfaction. Bhagavat, the personality of Godhead. Katayam, in the topics of. Sanchodita, being so infused. Tam, unto the Dura. Rahasam, with smiles. Iha, like that. Aha, reply. Translation. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, Thus the chief of the sages, who was always enthusiastic about describing topics regarding the personality of Godhead, began to narrate the descriptive explanation of the Puranas, being so infused by Vidura. He was very much enlivened by speaking on the transcendental activities of the Lord. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Great learned sages like Maitreya Muni are always very enthusiastic about describing the transcendental activities of the Lord. Maitreya Muni, being thus invited by Vidura to speak, appeared to be smiling because he actually felt transcendental bliss. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta purports of the third canto, seventh chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam entitled Further Inquiries by Vidura. So here we see that after being asked many wonderful questions by Vidura, that Maitreya is going to answer those questions, and he's going to answer those questions by speaking, as it says here, a descriptive explanation of the Puranas. In Kali Yuga, it is actually more important to read the Puranas or the supplements to the Vedas than the original Vedas themselves. We have the Rig, Atharva, Yajur, Samaveda, and sometimes, or generally, in many traditions where they're trying to follow Vedic culture or the Vedic knowledge. They're placing, they're studying predominantly those scriptures, if they're studying scriptures at all. And their understanding of the Puranas is they don't understand the importance of them in Kali Yuga. They're very, very important in Kali Yuga because they're much easier. They're for the general population, you know, everyone can understand because they're compiled not for the professors of the Vedas, but they're compiled so that knowledge which is in the Vedas, that the professors of the Vedas can then disseminate to the people in general. So they're very, very important. And amongst them, Srimad Bhagavatam, or the Bhagavad Purana, is the Amala Purana, or the spotless Purana, the best amongst all the Puranas. And there are many. All of these things are actually described in the Shastras themselves. The Shastras speak these things. That's where we get that information. The Vedic literatures encourage us to read Srimad Bhagavatam. And especially in this age of Kali. And so, for instance, I find that there are many people who follow Hindu culture, and what is very popular amongst them, a bit of a fashion, is what they call Satyanarayan Puja. People sometimes ring the temple. Can you do Satyanarayan Puja? If anyone asks that, if anyone answers the phone, say, I'll just get you to speak to Ganga. Don't say, no, we don't do that. Just say, I'll get you to speak to Ganga. Because I go there and I actually explain to them that the Satyanarayan Puja is from the, I think, Bhavishya Purana. And, it's for those who are interested in being situated in this world in a pious way, in the mode of goodness. It's not, it doesn't help one come to the transcendental platform. It's not the essential teachings of the Vedas. It's, it's there. It's something in one of the Puranas which perhaps in other ages may have been suitable for various purposes. But, because what happens, as we described, one family does it and everyone follows without ever questioning. So I generally explain to them that, this Satyanarayan Puja is actually spoken by and explained to them by Sudha Goswami, and that the main topic that... So by introducing Sudha Goswami, then they have faith in the author that, we have faith in Sudha Goswami, he's teaching the Satyanarayan Puja. So then I explain that from his own lips... He describes the importance of Srimad Bhagavatam. And, of course, I don't quote all the verses, but, there are many strong verses spoken by Sudha Goswami that basically, if one doesn't read Srimad Bhagavatam in the course of his life, his whole life is wasted. It's a great blight or mark that in the course of our entire lifetime, if we do not read the Srimad Bhagavatam, other things are almost useless to us. Like that. So this is the same author. So Maitreya Muni, he's going to speak the descriptive explanation of the Puranas. So the Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll actually find that many of the stories which are there in all the Puranas are there in Srimad Bhagavatam. But particularly the Srimad Bhagavatam is organized to enliven others to hear about and glorify the transcendental activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is the difference. In fact, Śrīla Vyāsadeva had compiled the 18 Puranas, including the Bhagavata Purana, and then he revised the Bhagavata Purana, and that took the form of the Śrīmad Bhagavatam. That revised edition of the Bhagavata Purana became the Śrīmad Bhagavatam, just making sure that everything was dedicated towards understanding the hearing and chanting about the Supreme Personality of Godhead exclusively, without any other topics at all. And therefore, Suta Goswami, practically, you know, if you take all the various religious practices that many people may be following in, you know, Hindu culture, you find that you know, the last word of the of Suta Goswami and Śrīla Vyāsadeva, who disseminated those religious principles, is better, in fact, practically an absolute necessity, follow the principles of the Bhagavatam. You can safely put all that aside and just follow Bhagavatam. Actually, if you don't, there is something seriously amiss. And the one is not properly protected from the material energy, and not being protected from the material energy, you know, one is in a precarious position, even though following those. So these are the opinions of Sukadeva Goswami. So Maitreya Muni, he's going to speak on the glories of the Lord from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And described here that the chief of the sages was always enthusiastic about describing topics regarding the personality of Godhead. And then Prabhupada, because taking the words from the Sanskrit verse, Prabhupada mentions in his purport that Maitreya Muni, being thus invited by Vidura to speak, appeared to be smiling because he actually felt transcendental bliss. So he was very, very enthusiastic and feeling great transcendental bliss to be able to hear and chant the glories of the Lord with Vidura. And this is the symptom of the pure devotees of the Lord. They're not really interested in, you know, all the other aspects of Vedic literature just for the sake of studying Vedic literature. They're interested in the other departments of Vedic literature in so much as it may support the hearing and chanting of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, we see here it describes that Maitreya Muni is always enthusiastic. So, really, had we not had the opportunity to have the associations throughout the world of Srila Prabhupada, we probably wouldn't really be able to probably understand the nature of that transcendental enthusiasm. It's something that is far exceeds any materialistic enthusiasm for anything. And it's also, you know, that enthusiasm of, that Srila Prabhupada demonstrated, which is common to the great devotees of the Lord, it can't be imitated as well. It can't be imitated. I'll just, I brought along this book here. You read that one? Prabhupada Nectar, little, what's that, where it goes from, a little saying, a little, just little paragraphs, little pastimes, little things that Prabhupada said, which are very significant, that extremely significant, but may not necessarily end up in the biographies. So here's one just to start off. It's called "Don't Sleep in Class." Start off with that one. We were talking about how, you know, Enthusiasm, it can't be imitated. So, in 1974, when Garuda Das was a new bhakta, he had a tendency to fall asleep during Srimad Bhagavatam class. He went with the devotees to India for the Mayapur festival, and while in Vrindavan, he got the chance to hear Prabhupada give Bhagavatam class. Imagine, you know, how greatly fortunate, you know, one is. I meet some of the Indian gentlemen who heard Srila Prabhupada, or you know, some of them may have organized a car for him in South Africa. You know, they just had maybe just the tiniest little association, but you know, when they talk about it, you can see it's like the highlight of their life. It's, you know, they're extremely, you know, they feel so fortunate. Just, you know, little, they'll never forget it. They stick again, and every time I meet them, they tell the same story, and I always love to hear the same story. It's just so nice. Anyway, so here he's in Vrindavan. He's hearing from Srila Prabhupada, supposedly. During his lecture, Srila Prabhupada appeared to look in Garuda's direction. He pointed and said, "What is he doing?" Garuda thought his devotional life was about to come to an end. Prabhupada again asked, "What is he doing?" and he instructed the devotees to tell him to leave. Some devotees started walking over there, where Garuda was sitting. Garuda thought he was really going to get it, but the devotee suddenly stopped and told the devotee sitting in front of him to leave the assembly. Never again did Garuda fall asleep in Bhagavatam class. So, even though he wasn't being chastised, it was close enough that, you know, by Krishna's arrangement. Anyway, while Prabhupada was travelling in India in 1971, one of his sannyasi servants, Devananda Maharaj, had difficulty staying awake in class. Even when Devananda Swami would sit as straight as a yogi, he would still close his eyes. In the middle of class, Prabhupada would then say, "Don't come here to class and sleep. Go away and sleep 24 hours a day, but don't come and fall asleep in front of me." On another occasion, Prabhupada again noticed devotees sleeping during Bhagavatam class. He became annoyed and asked the devotees, "Why this sleeping phenomenon? Why are you all sleeping? Is it because you don't get enough sleep at night?" The devotees attempted to respond. "It's because we're going to bed late," someone said. "It's because we're eating too much at night," someone else said. Srila Prabhupada made a sour face, shook his head, and said that even if they slept 14 hours a night, they would still sleep in class. He said their excuses were no answers and that they would only stay awake when they had the conviction that their work in Krishna consciousness was so important that they had no time to sleep. Prabhupada spoke so forcefully that everyone's attention became riveted. I think there's also a, Prabhupada mentions that one of the purports in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that one conquers over sleep by strong desire, you know, intense desire. That's, which is, you know, very important. We know that one should be moderate in eating, you know, and what have you, in order to, that helps. But ultimately, even if, as Prabhupada said, it's a fact that even if someone sleeps 14 hours a night, if there's no desire, no strong conviction about their Krishna consciousness activities, they'll still sleep at that. So, so Prabhupada, he was a very... very enthusiastic preacher, and he wanted his disciples to come to that platform, but again, it's not something that's just artificially followed. It's manifest by coming to the spiritual platform. So Prabhupada, here's one saying. He says, I think it is very obvious, this is a letter to one of his disciples, and you have admitted that the problem is that you are not following the basic principles for our society. The fact that you have not chanted your rounds for a long time is enough to make you without any spiritual strength. So, you know, the enthusiasm to preach Krishna consciousness is a spiritual strength, which is based upon, regular chanting, rounds, following the regular principles, and also, studying, regular studying, and also serving. Here's another letter here. Prabhupada says, you say you want to go to preach to the Mayavadi Swamis, but if you go to those rascals, they will convert you. You are not so strong that you can convince them and convert them from their foolishness. It is distinctly said in the Bhagavad Gita that the purpose of Vedic knowledge is to understand Krishna. Vaidesh cha saveraham eva vidyaha. Bhagavad Gita 15:55. So we are presenting Krishna in so many ways, politically, socially, economically, philosophically and religiously, etc. We are describing him in 75 books of 400 pages each. Better read these books thoroughly and be firmly convinced yourself before going to these demons for convincing them. If you are weak yourself while trying to convert them, you will be converted by them. Don't try any hard task before you are very strong. Chant 16 rounds daily. Follow the rules and regulations and read our books. Don't become a very big preacher immediately. Again, there are different statements. There's one devotee who said to Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, I want to go and preach and like this. And Prabhupada just said straight out, not everyone can preach. In one sense, everyone can preach. Prabhupada used to, give the example of Saraswati, the little girl who was just a few years old. She would approach people who would come to the temple and she would say, who is God? And they'd, oh, I don't know. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Prabhupada, that doesn't mean we can send her out on the streets. there's a great difficulty in ISKCON with the children because even though they get so much Krishna consciousness from their parents and in the temple, as soon as you put them in the schools, apparently everything is lost. And, Prabhupada called it the slaughterhouse education. And it's very dangerous that, within a few weeks, you see children, their whole Krishna consciousness can slacken considerably, and over a couple of years, it's almost gone. So everyone can preach, to some degree, but to, be strong preacher, Prabhupada, gave strong warnings like this: don't be a big preacher immediately. Don't imitate. You study the books thoroughly, all of Prabhupada's books, and chant and follow the rules and regulations like that. So that's where this enthusiasm to preach comes from. Again, another, you know, similar quote. This is one day in Vrindavan, Srila Prabhupada allowed a morning darshan in his room, but some of the important devotees were absent. When he asked where they were, he was told that some of the devotees were cleaning the temple. Prabhupada was surprised. Cleaning the temple? We can employ people to clean the temple, but one thing you cannot employ people to do is to preach. So they should hear from me when I am speaking, or how will they preach? It's one thing I've noticed, just you know, not that we should be too fanatical about these things, but you know, just in general, I notice that there's previously, you know, going back in the late 70s, you know, 80s, when there was class, practically every single devotee was in class. And they were there from the very beginning, from the beginning of Jai Radha Madhava, chanting all the prayers and the whole thing. And from the start to finish, they were there. I still remember the kirtans that we used to have before class. They're some of the most memorable kirtans, because every single devotee, you know, was there. And the place was always, even though there wasn't a lot. There was actually, we have more devotees now and less devotees come to class than what we had then. Place was packed, you know, every single devotee. And if you weren't in class, if devotees saw you in the courtyard or doing something, even you're doing service, what are you doing? Class is on. And, oh no, I'll just say, I'm going to do some sweeping, you know, privilege. Go to class. Do that. You know, it was like that. It was just same. This, because of this mood Prabhupada had, he had that mood. And you don't see that so much now. That movement, I sort of miss that to some degree. But, you know, it's understandable. I mean, we have, in another sense, we can't be fanatical because there are a lot of devotees. It's a bigger movement, and therefore there's a lot more, you know, so much prasadam to be cooked and something, you know, a lot more things to be done. So, you know, nirpujaris and what have you. So, you know, there are certain devotees that must do their services, you know, during class. But I think what happens is because this mood is not here, that, you know, in the name of doing services or the name of, you know, even chanting, you know, devotees just don't, may not have a taste for hearing, you know, that enthusiasm. And yet, everyone wants to be a big preacher, and yet there may not be a taste for hearing Srimad Bhagavatam class. So, you know, Prabhupada, very, very strong point, you know. We can employ people to clean the temple. We used to have a cleaner in Adelaide temple. You know, you pay them, and she'd come in, and she'd clean up. That's a very good cleaner. But you can't pay someone to come and preach. That they have to study Prabhupada's books and read. Here's another letter by Prabhupada. If you feel at all indebted to me, then you should preach vigorously like me. This is the proper way to repay me. Of course, no one can repay the debt to the spiritual master, but the spiritual master is very pleased by such an attitude by the disciple. In another letter he said, yes, preaching is more important than management. Just because you are preaching nicely and distributing so much prasadam, management will follow like a shadow and Krishna will send you unlimited help. And then, just on Prabhupada's method of preaching, a couple of nice verses here, but here's one. He says, one time in Hawaii, Prabhupada was discussing how he was able to defeat the non-devotees' arguments. I know the art like karate, he said, of pushing on a person's weak spot until he dies. I find their weak point and I push until they die. which is, although that's a statement, actually, if you listen to all of Prabhupada's conversations, where there may be questions, even morning walks, that method Prabhupada followed. That people may object to Krishna consciousness in different ways, they may refute it in different ways. But Prabhupada, he would speak on, he would not necessarily try to convince a person by explaining all of the wonderful things that are there in the Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, it wasn't like, well, you know, you've got your book, we've got our book, and our book's just got so much more in it than your book, you know, like this Radharani and this Krishna, you know, like that. He didn't try to impress them by like that. What he would do is that if they said something which was where they were challenging the validity of a Krishna conscious principle, he would just stay on that point, that one point. And he would just keep discussing. He would, for 2 hours, he would just go, on that one point. Because he understood that there's generally no point going further. You know, if someone is finds a complete stumbling block on one of the basic principles of devotional service, there's no use sort of just preaching, to that person for half an hour, giving him so much information, so much knowledge. Sometimes, of course, in a general assembly, we know that there may be a few people who are, struggling, but the general assembly of people that they're preaching to are following the lecture, so you may continue and answer questions later. But, on a small group, one-to-one basis, Prabhupada understood, well, there's no use, just speaking philosophy for the sake of Krishna Katha. This person has a serious understanding. If they don't understand this point, everything else I say after that will not actually really make an impression. So he would just press on that point. And he would also, the principle is, the principle is that if you find one fault in someone's philosophy, then the whole philosophy can be rejected. In India, just like with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he addressed all the brahmanas on this question of that they were considering devotees not qualified as brahmanas, and the Vaishnavas were not as elevated as brahmanas, and so many different things, and that they didn't have a right, Vaishnavas didn't have a right to worship the deities or chant the Gayatri Mantra, so many different things. So on this one point, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he spoke, and at first, of course, he glorified the brahmanas, and the brahmanas, oh yes, he's glorifying us. But then as he quoted so many scriptural evidences, he fully described, the faulty mentality of thinking that a brahmana situated in the mode of goodness can ever really compare themselves with a Vaishnava on the transcendental platform. And because they understood the fault has been exposed, the entire audience surrendered unto him. These are all great devotees and yogis. They all surrendered to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. They accepted, yes, you are the guru. Like that, we follow you, we take shelter of you. Like that. So, let's see. I'll just describe a little bit about his preaching spirit and his preaching method. In the evening, he wanted to see guests. We suggested he not see people who would waste his time, and he agreed, but then he would become angry with us if we kept people from seeing him because he existed for preaching to them. It was his duty to preach, he felt. Prabhupada was self-satisfied and never restless or bored. Yet if the place was really quiet with no preaching there, he seemed to want to go where there was some action. This was also a manifestation of his desire to accomplish as much as possible. Prabhupada was already accomplished in terms of self-realization and love of Krishna. Therefore, his travel was only for the benefit of others. He felt he had to travel and he kept on the move. When he arrived in a new place, he was immediately ready to see the local people. The room would fill up and he would preach for hours. This feature of Prabhupada's behavior was astounding. Day and night, people would come into his room, sometimes a few, sometimes many. Prabhupada would always speak to them about Krishna. He would speak on the basis of the Bhagavad Gita, calling for verses to be cited, answering questions, preaching, much as in his classes. The informal talks were more unusual. Many of his talks in later years were recorded. He would preach, preach, preach. He kept going, hours on end, preaching the basic philosophy, holding the room full of people, then taking a little prasadam and distributing it. When he would travel to certain places, as in Europe, where he could speak to many people and bring them to devotional service, he would be especially enlivened to preach. Preaching included encouraging the local ISKCON disciples wherever he visited, and preaching also meant his book writing. It also meant his spirit of maintaining and expanding ISKCON in all its activities. We cannot describe the full glories of his preaching spirit. His enthusiasm was unlimited, and even today is nourishing all the preachers of ISKCON. When he was ill and feeling inconvenienced, when the people he was speaking to were low class or disinterested, when his body was very old, and when in order to preach he had to interrupt his schedule, when there was difficulty going on within ISKCON, still his preaching would go on. Sitting at his low desk talking, his eyes sometimes widening, hands sometimes gesturing, taking water to drink, chanting almost soundless japa when not talking, focusing in on special guests to develop a whole argument with them. Prabhupada was intent on his preaching points, although he had made the same point millions of times. Thus, he was not just a scholar, but a pure devotee attempting to convince everyone that they had to change, the whole world had to change or else. I'll just leave it maybe with one last quote and we'll have a couple of questions. There is talking about the different ways Prabhupada was preaching. Even by his gesturing and, there's Satsarup Maharaj in one place, he describes how, sometimes Prabhupada would be, just telling stories. And if he would talk about a train, he would then just make with his voice the exact sound of a train or a frog croaking, or birds, So he was very, very, expressive, both verbally and physically in the way he preached. Not just by speaking, but his whole mannerisms, everything. Here's a nice little story that shows that. Jamuna Dasi was not sure of how Srila Prabhupada wanted the deity of Srimati Radharani to appear. Often, Radharani's right hand is raised with the palm facing outward and her left hand is at her side holding a lotus. In Mayapur, at Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's temple, however, Radharani's arms are bent and her hands are at the same height. Should she be like that? Jamuna Dasi asked Prabhupada. No, said Srila Prabhupada. She should stand like this. And Prabhupada struck a pose. He raised his right hand and cupped his palm, and he bent his left arm and held the palm downward. He then turned his head and tilted it slightly. To Jamuna Dasi, Prabhupada appeared to be in a classic and very graceful pose of Srimati Radharani dancing. Then Prabhupada said, if Radharani were to stop dancing, the whole business would be finished. He then explained that in Vrindavan, Radharani never stops dancing, and that of all her super excellent qualities, Radharani's cooking and her dancing are particularly outstanding. Prabhupada said that no one can excel Radharani in her ability to please Krishna by cooking, and that she cooks for him eternally without ever making the same preparation twice. In this way, Prabhupada explained, she keeps Krishna under her control. Then he said that even above her cooking skill is her dancing skill. Therefore, Prabhupada said, in the Krishna Balaram Mandir in Vrindavan, Srimati Radharani will be dancing. Later he said, Radharani is the colour of sindoor powder and Hindu powder mixed with milk. So I'll just leave it there, just get some more quotes there, we'll run out of time. Any questions or comments on that? Yeah. Thus being questioned, one who knows how to explain the supplements of the Vedas, so the Purana Kalpaha, Kuru Padena, by the chief of the Kurus, Muni Padena, the chief amongst the sages, Prabhupada sufficiently enriched, being so infused, tam unto Vidura, Rashaun with smiles like that replied, tam unto Vidura. So, you know, it appears that because, you know, tam meaning unto Vidura, he replied, it coming last, that therefore the descriptions are referring to Maitreya Muni. Maitreya was related to Vyasadeva, is that correct? No. What's that?
This
Purana
was released with
what's that?
Purana.
Yes. Not at all. Rasa Nandini, in the back of the book there's Maitreya Rishi, some pages where it's mentioned. I'll have a look at 142, 143 if you go to maybe 163, 164. And just have a look at that. I'm sure there was some. It says here, Maitreya was one of the disciples of Maharishi Parasarada, the father of Vyasadeva. Thus Vyasadeva and Maitreya were friends and mutual well-wishers. So he was a disciple of Parasara, the father of Vyasadeva. Doesn't mean that he's not a guru. He seems to have a, as a guide, guru, spiritual teacher, associated very intimately, as a friend of Vyasadeva, certainly very intimately associated with the gurus, but it doesn't say here that, what his relationship is, but there's a faint distant memory somewhere that, he may be one of the Kuru dynasty, but here, it would be unusual that because Srila Vyasadeva is mentioned, that Vidura is mentioned at the very end of that verse, that the descriptions would relate to him and not Maitreya. Sure, the point is it. The other thing here, of course, is that because Vidura is, Vidura is a very advanced saintly person himself. Still, you'd question whether it was proper to call Vidura the chief amongst sages at a time when he's taking instruction from Maitreya. So there's a question of etiquette. Chief among the Kurus, to call him the chief amongst the Kurus, or the chief amongst the sages, they're both describing that one person.
Just wanted to raise an issue, just to try and clarify.
But where you could find out is in the commentaries of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti-Thakura, because usually when he does a word for word, he'll actually mention those different points there. So that's where you got that?
I know what it is.
That's good. Okay. Let me know. The Gayatri Mantra, he becomes, the Guru becomes enthused as he enthuses us. So the spiritual master, he becomes enthused as he enthuses us. And similarly, describes that the spiritual master becomes satisfied by seeing his disciples, accepting Krishna Prasad. So there is, the topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam, hearing and chanting, are very, very attractive, you know, the life and soul, literally, not just attractive, but the life and soul of the pure devotees. But at the same time, there's an extra taste in seeing people, you know, also, you know, derive that when that taste is infused within others, there's a special taste in that as well. So that, therefore, preaching has a special flavor. You know, it has the preaching, as Prabhupada describes, it's part of the raga marg. You know, we have the vaidhi bhakti, where we follow the rules and regulations. We may not have a strong taste, but we know we should do it, so we follow the rules and regulations. By the force of the guru, by the force of shastra, we may not necessarily have a strong taste, but we do it. Raga marg is when one has a taste, and it's a spontaneous activity out of, you know, one is enjoying that activity on the transcendental platform. And preaching comes under that category of raga marga. Therefore, as I said, Prabhupada said, not everyone can preach, because it is actually the activity, properly, of the Madhyama Adhikaris, not so much the Kanishna Adhikaris. You know? Kanishna Adhikaris can preach as well, but they may actually be swayed by the association they're getting, or even the arguments, you know. You know, you can speak to someone and so many people have so many different objections to Krishna being the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I was speaking to someone the other day, and they were Jains, and they were saying to me that, you know, in the Jain philosophy, although they accept Krishna as a great personality, and even as an avatar, still they consider that because he fought in the battle of Kurukshetra, he's accepting the sinful reaction for that, and for many, many lifetimes he has to work off that karma at that. And while he's doing that, you know, their avatars coming in their line are sort of really filling in and, you know, doing the real preaching and distributing, the, you know, like that. Therefore, so, but you know, you come across so many different things that you know, devotees don't even like to hear. But actually, a young devotee, if they're constantly, if you're speaking Krishna consciousness, and every single person you meet in the course of the day objects to Krishna, and then you go out the next day and every single person you meet objects to Krishna being the Supreme Person of Godhead or his teaching. So then you go out the next day and every single person objects. You know, you do that week after week. It can, you know, wear you down. Especially if, you know, then you have, you know, authorities or, you know, the local government or what have you doesn't want you. So they're also harassing you. You know, you've probably heard different stories, Chincharupa Manaji telling about, you know, they used to, with my first partner, you know, going out and preaching and, you know, they would spend half the day running from the police and, you know, running into Myers and out the back door and, you know, being chased. You know, and if they get caught, they would either get fined or, you know, possibly thrown in jail. You know, as a when you went out in those days, you know, you were literally chased all over the city by people who wanted to stop you by any means. The local people. I've been thrown in jail 3 times just for being a devotee, just for going out and preaching. And, not just in a lockup, you know, in the big jail as well. Time was so in the early days we had to wear wigs, you know, if you could go out on Harinam, but if you went out to do anything else, distribute books or you know, to you know, collect donations, because we didn't have a congregation. We're very fortunate now, we have a very generous congregation, and, you know, they support the movement very nicely. We should always appreciate that, but in those days we didn't have that, so we had to go out and earn every penny the hard way. used to have to wear wigs, which was very embarrassing when you're like a, you know, 19, 20 years old and you get a freshly shaven head and, you know, you're wearing a wig. You know, people used to look at you, and when they look at you, they sort of, they'd look just above your hairline, you know, yet you always knew, you know. And one time I was selling candles, and I was up in the back of New South Wales, I was selling candles to, I had all the checkout chicks were buying candles, and they're all, you know, they're all pulling out their money and everything like that, and I was going to make this big sale. I had a couple of boxes of candles there, and then about six police walked in, right? And they said, you're being charged with obstructing pedestrians on the footpath. I wasn't even on the footpath. Right? I said, oh, well, you know, these girls are doing something. They picked me up, and literally just, you know, about four just picked me up, carried me outside, threw me in the back of the car, took me to jail, threw me in jail. Even we got a lawyer, they stole our money, stole my wig. Even we had a lawyer, because the authorities were so against us, they actually won the case. You know, like that. And that was, there's another time. I'll just tell you one last story. It's a funny one. We were in, you know, just shows you sometimes the animosity when people understood you're a devotee, what you actually faced. We used to do a lot of hotels. Because people had money and they were drunk and they, you know, they were easy part of their money, so, you know, they'd buy different things. Anyway, I was with another devotee, a couple of devotees. We went into a hotel way out in somewhere, and out in the country. we pulled the car up out the front. We usually park it so we can make a quick getaway, should the need be. Anyway, we were each selling, the, you know, they have the pews and there's a tape in the middle, so we each, you know, selling our candles. And someone spotted the wig. Right? So I was standing there like this. And then all the men stood up and then they surrounded me. And the guy says, look what we got ourselves here. He put his, he went to grab my hair and punch me in the face at the same time. But when he grabbed my hair, it come off. And it surprised him. So just for that split moment, like, and everyone looked, like, what happened? Did you pull his hair off, you know? And at that moment, I just ran underneath and just ran out of the car. Another devotee who was actually there had banged someone on the head with his candle. He'd run out, and someone, the other devotee was in the car, it was almost like a getaway car, you know, dust flying, jump in the window, jump in the door, and, you know, and then off to the next hotel to do the same thing. And you just do that all day, because, you know, so we used to have the atmosphere week. Anyway, the point is that, you know, preaching is, you know, it's good to be, you know, try and be fixed up as a devotee, you know, and preach. But there is a special nectar in spreading Krishna consciousness despite all obstacles. By Krishna's grace, you get the nectar of seeing people become Krishna conscious, which is great nectar, and you get the nectar of seeing how Krishna protects you under all circumstances. That's another special nectar which you get as a preacher. So, you know, this enthusiasm, even here in Maitreya, it doesn't quite, we don't quite get a glimpse of the enthusiasm as what we do from Prabhupada, because Prabhupada had a special enthusiasm because he was preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world. Like that. Taking, you know, and here Maitreya is speaking to Vidura. He's already, you know, practically a liberated person. Prabhupada is sweeping up the Chandalas and the Malechas, you know, off the streets and turning them into, you know, nice Vaishnavas. Imagine his ecstasy, you know. The first time practically in the history of Brahma's day, imagine how enthusiastic, how like that, and taking so many risks, and, you know, Krishna protecting. So there's a special taste in hearing and chanting, but especially if you preach.
Trying to preach in like communist countries or in Russia, they were very close to getting killed.
Some were killed.
Some were killed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Prabhupada also explains that, you know, we should preach according to time, place, and circumstance. Mm-hmm. So, why they have to take so much risk and infiltrate into an environment which is unsafe to preach?
And they were great preachers, so, you know, they were, you know, they were prepared to die. So, you know, they fixed up the bodies. They're glorious. Yes, it is, you know, so isn't it? Therefore Prabhupada gave stern warnings. Don't imitate. You know, don't imitate a big preacher. You know.
I mean, we should preach intelligently.
They were preaching intelligently, but, you know, as a result of their preaching, you know, Russia and places like that, they're literally the biggest zones, you know, like where they have the rate of devotees that are joining the Krishna consciousness fully, enthusiastically, tens of thousands of people, as a result of the sacrifices that those devotees made. Otherwise we'd still be sitting here saying, oh, you know, it's too dangerous. Therefore, what they did was very intelligent. They gave their life, and that inspired. Even now, in those countries, you know, with certain countries where there are devotees, you know, the governments are very antagonistic to Krishna consciousness. Those devotees take great inspiration from the risks that, you know, the original devotees took. Yes, there's danger, but we take inspiration from them. Okay. We still take inspiration from Prabhupada. Prabhupada took so many risks. If I just said to you now, you know, I'm going to, you know, drop you off in Bolivia, you know, the set of cartels and, you know, $7 or $8, and you can, you know, start Krishna consciousness over there. Well, you do it. Prabhupada took that risk. At 70, you're a young man. You know, we had no idea. You know, Prabhupada, he could have just died. He had, everyone told him it was foolish. You're a fool. You cannot go. They wouldn't let him go. He was determined. He was prepared to die, and he nearly did die. You know. But if he didn't take that risk, where would we be here? So do we say Prabhupada was a fool? No. So yes, you know, that preaching is there, but you know, we can't imitate, we shouldn't take unnecessary risks, is correct. But sometimes devotees do, because they will risk everything to somehow, you know, think a little foothold and help people become Krishna conscious, and in order to fulfill the order of the spiritual master. That's intention.